Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Urich, and I'm so excited for today's guest. I've actually been waiting years and years and years to talk to Jonathan Haidt. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Ginny. What an enthusiastic welcome.
I can't even tell you. I am so excited. Have you ever had something that you've waited for years and didn't even know was even a possibility? And then here you are in that moment. Oh. I read your book that you wrote with Greg, The Coddling of the American Mind, years and years ago, and it was so eye-opening for me. And I also have The Canceling of the American Mind that you wrote the foreword to, but your most recent book that's out, coming out, people can order it, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. These are the books that every parent needs to read, every teacher, anyone who works with kids. So thank you for taking the time to be here with us.
My pleasure. You're doing great work on one of the major pieces of the problem, which is get kids outside, get them out from under adult supervision.
Sure. Yes, it's huge. I loved so many things about your book. And I told you right before we started that I have 14 pages of notes just from The Anxious Generation. I probably have a similar amount from The Coddling of the American Mind. One of the things I really loved in particular, Jonathan, was you did an amazing job of taking something that has swept through culture that no one's really thinking too much about because everyone's doing it and reframing it so that someone would take a step back and say, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. That really is what's going on. And there were so many of those, even how you started it with the trip to Mars. One of the ones I really liked was the salesman. If you went into an electronics store with the salesman. So I just, we'll weave that in, but I want to let parents know that if you're wanting to have a new perspective, a shift of perspective as to what's going on with our kids, it was all the way throughout the book, and I thought it was phenomenal. But something that really caught my eye, it's one of the main premises of the book, is that from 2010 to 2015, childhood changed. And one of the things that you said was, Gen Z became the first generation in history to go through puberty with a portal in their pocket that called them away from people nearby into an alternative universe that was exciting. This book is so good. Exciting, addictive, unstable, and unsuitable for children and adolescents. You say, on average, people born in and after 1996 were different psychologically from those who had been born just a few years earlier. Different psychologically.
Yes.
From just a few years. Has this ever happened before?
No, I don't think there's ever been, I mean, you know, maybe there was a plague sometime in the 14th century that killed off half the people and then the kids born in the plague, you know, but not since we have historical records. There's never been anything like this. So a lot of psychologists have shown or written about how over the decades, you know, since World War II, Americans are more neurotic, more depressed, more anxious. And this is just part of the general process of growing soft and rich and all the things that are happening. So there's a long, slow increase in children's pathology and a decrease in toughness. Every generation says, oh, the kids today are soft. That's been going on for hundreds of years. But what happened in around 2012 is unprecedented. It's not just that the numbers for depression, anxiety, suicide, it's not just that they like kept going up. Because actually, they've been actually kind of going down in the 90s and the 2000s. The millennials were actually more mentally healthy than Gen X before them. So some of the indicators were kind of going, the you know problems were kind of going down until you get to around 2012. And all of a sudden, almost everything you can measure about bad mental health, especially for girls, goes up. It looks like a hockey stick. You know, you've got these lines going down and then boom, it just goes right up. That is unprecedented. And what really alarmed me was when my research buddy here, Zach Rausch, I asked him to find all the data you can on other countries. Let's aggregate everything we can find on what's happening to teens in other countries. And when Zach created graphs that showed the same hockey stick patterns in Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, this is something that happened to young people in the early 2010s in many, many countries, not all countries. It's not so clear in East Asia, but at least in countries that have a lot of liberty, freedom, the Protestant countries in Europe, this is happening in many, many countries. That's why I say it's a rewiring and it's a generation that is anxious compared to the one before it.
I talked to this Thomas Kirsting. He's an author. He's a school psychologist. And he said in 2012, he said in 2011, no one had ever come in for anxiety. He's working in a high school, right? He said in 2012, everyone came in for anxiety. that yeah. 1 year is such a switch. Yeah. And I think what's confusing about it as a parent is it's been this slow creep of overprotection. Mm-hmm. Like you talk about, kids were outside and then just slowly it's changed. Mm-hmm. And screens have been around. I mean, they were around. Yeah. I had read a book by Maria von Trapp, who, you know, from The Sound mm-hmm. of Music, and she oh. was complaining. She was complaining about screens. Yeah. You know, they're taking away from our family time, these baseball games. So right. it's been around for a long time, both of those things. But what you narrow it down to is it's this marriage of mm-hmm. these two things that have both escalated
yeah.
sort of at the same time. And actually, Jonathan, I think that's a big message of hope. That there aren't 500 things yeah. that are causing where we're at. There are two.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And if we could deal with even just one of them,
yeah.
your child might be in a better spot. So mm-hmm. can we start with the safetyism? The sure. safetyism is something that's changed since my childhood, where kids kind of ran amok. Mm-hmm. And I loved the way that you put this. I think people should put this on their refrigerators. You say we're overprotecting in the real world, underprotecting online in the virtual world.
Exactly. That's right.
Wow. So tell yeah. us about safetyism. What's changed?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Back when families were larger, there were more kids. There was a real baby boom in the 50s and 60s. There were a lot of kids around and there weren't so many labor-saving devices. So, you know, mothers were busy. They had a lot of work to do around the house. Kids went out and entertained each other. The idea that a mother in the 40s, 50s, or 60s would spend her time supervising her kids was absurd. Go out and, you know, as you would say, stay out till the streetlights come on. That was the norm. And this is the way I grew up. I was born in 1963, which means that I was raised during the biggest crime wave in modern times. In the 70s and 80s was a huge crime wave. And so there was some danger. There were drunk drivers. But even still, you know, even in New York City, I grew up in a suburb, but even in New York City, kids were out playing. And, you know, they were not generally mugged. Cars didn't run them over. I mean, adults and children found ways to live together so that kids could be out having fun and doing the things they need to do all the way up until the 80s. And that's when it really gets more intense. And what happens now is we have declining family size. So now the baby boom is over. Now a lot of families just have one child or two at most. There are not so many kids in the neighborhood, but mothers are going to work in much larger numbers. But here's the weird thing. In the 90s, I show a graph in the book. If you look at the number of hours that women spend with their kids, spend, you know, mothering or parenting or involved with their kids, it was a relatively low number in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And it's suddenly in the 90s, it goes way up, way up. Wow. Same for fathers, not quite as much. And it's in that decade in the 90s that we kind of dropped the old idea of kids get out, you know, go play outside, come back later, to everything is dangerous. If I take my eyes off you, you'll be kidnapped. Oh, and also, if I want you to go to college, I have to expose you to all kinds of amazing enrichment experience. I need to play Mozart when you're in utero, and I need to give you Baby Einstein videos and all this intensive parenting. So it was partly fear-driven and largely from the media environment, round-the-clock coverage of any time there was a missing child. And also partly changes in our economy, which may explain why it's the English-speaking countries that had this the worst. Because the Anglo world is a little bit more, has more like free market economics. It's more vibrant. It generates more wealth, but it also generates less security and more competition. And so these trends are huge in the English-speaking countries. They're also found in Scandinavia. So for that reason, I think things really begin to change. Childhood really, really changes, especially in the 90s. And by the late 90s, by the early 2000s, no one has seen a child outside unsupervised for so long that they begin to call the police. This wasn't happening in the 90s because people had seen children just a few years earlier. But right. by 2010, nobody had seen a seven-year-old outside without a parent. It was such a bizarre sight. It looked dangerous. You know, this kid, like, what if he walks into the street? He'll be killed. He'll be abducted. Yeah. And so once a few busybodies would call 911, help, there's a child outside with no parent. You know, once the police come, what are they going to do? They're going to bring the child home, and then they will often have to refer it to Child Protective Services because this family clearly neglected their child. And once that started happening, once parents hear about these cases, they know they can't even send their 8 or 9-year-old child down to the corner grocery store because mm-hmm. what'll happen? And so then you get this mass movement, we get a mass change of norms. So now it's no longer the educated rich people who are overparenting. It's now even working class people are doing this more concierge, protective, fearful parenting. Once we've done that, we've basically deprived kids of what they most need to develop. I mean, yes, they need love, they need oxygen and food. There's some very basic things they have to have. But once you get those basic needs met, mammals play. This is why I wanted to start off the book in this sort of strange way. I wanted to start talking about mammals. We're mammals. You know, mammals, they nurse their young. They make a huge investment in their, you know, reptiles, you lay the eggs, you go away, you're on your own, kid. But mammals, it's like, okay, you know, I'm gonna give you milk from my body. And I'm going to protect you. But the protection is actually to give you a home base so that you can go out and play. And anyone who's ever had a puppy or a kitten knows these little critters, they just want to play. And they have to, because that's how you wire up the big mammal brain. Mammals have very big brains compared to other creatures. So play is essential. It's not optional. It's not a nice to have. You know, it's like, you know, if you got a car with four uninflated tires, it wouldn't be like, you know, you have the option of inflating the tires. Like, no, you have to inflate the tires. And that's what the mammal brain is like. You have to inflate it with a lot of play. And we kind of cut back on that in the 80s and 90s, and then we really cut it off, you know, but at the same time we were cutting off play in the real world because we were so afraid. The exact same time, television was getting amazing. So when I was little, there were just three networks and one or two local stations. And then, you know, when I was in high school, we got cable TV, and now there's a lot more to watch. And then, you know, you get VHS, VCRs, TiVo. So we're spending a lot more time watching TV, but TV is not particularly harmful. It blocks out other activities, but TV doesn't harm you directly. And then the internet comes in the 90s, and wow, is that amazing. So by the late 90s, now you've got teenagers, especially boys, really interested in this online virtual stuff. So as we were overprotecting in the real world and keeping them home or under adult supervision, we gave them unlimited access to this amazing internet. And we thought, well, you know, this is the future. And I want my 7-year-old to spend time with it. Maybe he'll have a head start. Mm-hmm. Maybe he'll learn to program and create some amazing company. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with the best of intentions, we kind of directed our kids away from the real world, the outdoor world, where there are physical risks, into a world where there are zero physical risks, at least not directly, and huge psychological risks, which set you up for physical risks later because you're so anxious and you're being propositioned by strange men and you're being sold drugs and all kinds of bad stuff ends up happening. But we didn't realize that at the time. We were all so optimistic about the internet in the 90s and early 2000s. We didn't mind that our kids had traded in all their outdoor time for internet time.
It's so helpful, Jonathan, to have your eyes opened and to understand, because I think everyone lives in this swirling. Everyone knows something's off.
Yeah.
But for you to have narrowed it down and to walk through, and even for myself, I've read a lot of books about this topic. Obviously, a lot of research, talked to a lot of people, but there were so many things in your book, Jonathan, that were a light bulb. Even what you were just talking about, which was this thought of that once kids stopped playing outside, then all of a sudden it seemed abnormal. And when people are calling CPS because they've never seen a little kid outside, mm-hmm. then all of the other parents don't want to get involved with the kids who are outside.
Exactly.
Lest they be pinned as someone that's trying to steal a mm-hmm. child or something like that. So we even lost that community aspect.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And so many things in your book, I thought, oh, it's so interesting. It's so eye-opening. And even when you talk about this was a product of necessity. Kids played outside because parents had to cook a meal for 10 people or 8 people. Mm-hmm. And I think now parents also are really overwhelmed. It looks different. They're not maybe cooking for 10, but they're working. They've got 2 incomes or they're trying to make ends meet. We have a lot of people that are entrepreneurs, got your hands in a bunch of different pots. Mm-hmm. And so this is solving the same problem. It's keeping the kids occupied.
Right.
But not in a way that helps with their development.
That's right.
And so your book is so, it's so needed. I mean, we have to read this stuff. We have to know. We have to know that play is essential. I loved even the part about with the mammals that you talked about, the kitten. I never knew this, Jonathan. So many things in this book. You know, everyone knows that kittens, they pounce on yarn.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that. It's so fun.
Right.
And you said it's because it's like a mouse's tail.
That's right.
And I had no idea.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that will change my whole life.
Yeah.
I thought it was so interesting because they're playing in a way that helps their body develop.
Well, they're practicing the skills they'll need as an adult. Mm-hmm. So human boys are practicing war. They're practicing team versus team in conflict. Human girls are practicing relationship skills and mothering skills. you know, like the opening scene in the Barbie movie when, you know, all the girls have the little baby dolls and they're practicing mothering. And yeah, that's kind of limiting. But, you know, girls do have much more of an interest in playing mothering or playing parenting than boys do. So, you know, there are, just like puppies and kitties, we're all practicing for skills we'll need as an adult. Those are social skills, physical skills. You know, then as we get older, we think about our appearance, our identity, how to behave in public. As we get older, originally, I wasn't going to have a chapter on puberty. I was going to focus on play in childhood. And, you know, kids, they play a little less, you know, in puberty. They're still very playful, but it changes. And what I realized is, wait a second, I need a whole chapter on puberty, because puberty around the world is marked, traditional societies, as soon as a girl menstruates, okay, time for initiation rites. You're about to become a woman. You know, we're not just going to let you biologically get older and say, okay, now she's a woman. No, no, no. We have to put you through rituals, dance, sleeplessness, everybody around you singing. We have to change your status from child to woman. And that's not something you can do on your own. Identity is conferred by the group. So as children go through this transformation, they have initiation rites, they have rituals, they often get a new name, they wear different clothing. So this is just something humans do, is we help our children make it from childhood to adulthood. We help them all over the world. But what do we do today? Right around age 10 or 11, we give them a phone. That's the average age now. You get a phone. And then they just lie about their age. They get on social media. And now they're doing 5 hours a day, the most recent data, 5 hours a day just on social media. A lot of that is TikTok and YouTube. So it includes a lot of his video watching time, but 5 hours a day just on the social media platforms, and 9 hours a day total, including all the other stuff. And that's not including homework or schoolwork. That's just recreation, 9 hours a day. That pushes out everything else. But it's not just that it pushes out everything else. Think about a kid entering early puberty. Think about a girl who is, her body is just beginning to change. She's being flooded with hormones. People are reacting differently to her. It's a very confusing time. Now is when the community of women would take her under their wing and socialize her into, how do you deal with men? How do you deal with your period? You know, a community of women would gather around her and help her make the transition. But what do? Here's your phone, go on TikTok, and a bunch of random weirdos who were selected by an algorithm because they were the most extreme, we'll let them socialize you. How about that? We'll let random people on the internet be your guide to adulthood. And then we're surprised that members of Gen Z, who are now 28, the oldest are 28, they're not doing well. They're not doing well as young adults. They're less likely to be dating, to be married, to have children. They're much more anxious. The mental illness problems persist into young adulthood. Basically, we've deprived children of childhood, and now we're seeing the result.
It's emotional. I feel emotional about that.
That's right. It's unbelievable what we've done. I mean, it's so vast, you can't wrap your head around it.
Yeah.
You know, the closest I can get is lead poisoning. We had all this lead in the gasoline. We were putting lead up into the air. It was falling. You know, children were playing in the dirt. They were eating food that had lead on it. And it damaged brain development back in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, that was a horror that we did that to kids. This is much bigger because it's most kids.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me emotional because I think back to my own childhood and how hard it was as a seventh grader. I mean, I specifically remember seventh grade.
Yeah, that's the worst. That's the peak year of bullying.
As being just an awful year and not ever wanting to go back. I don't ever want to go back to school. And it was, these friends would not be friends with you one day and the next day. And it was just so awful. And I try and empathize. I try and think, what would it have been like if also I was being videotaped the whole time? Like, what would it also have been? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big piece. We can't really wrap our head around it. But, you know, some of the kids are saying, you don't talk to anybody. Everyone is on their phones. Right. I had posted a podcast recently. I interviewed a high school senior. It almost reminds me of the people that are no longer, you know, you want to talk to the World War II veterans because there's only a few of them left. And we're sort of in that spot. Like, there's only a few of them left. There's only a few kids left maybe that their parents didn't give them a phone and they made it through their whole high school experience. And so I talked to this girl. She didn't get a phone until she was in the ninth grade, which is unprecedented at this point. Mm-hmm. But she was saying how everyone is on their phone. Mm-hmm. As soon as you get in the class, as soon as the class is over, the lunchroom is quiet.
That's right. It's bizarre. It's creepy. That's right. When schools go phone free, and this is one of the four recommendations I make, when schools go phone free, it's a universal observation. You hear laughter. You hear kids talking. Because most schools say they ban phones, but all they mean is we have a rule that you're not allowed to use your phone during class. So what do the students do? Many of them, especially if they're not sitting in the front row, they just put it in their lap. They put it behind a book. So they are texting during class. Some of the boys are watching porn. All kinds of things are happening during class, but it's surreptitious. They have to kind of keep it hidden. And then what happens when the bell rings? They go out into the hallway, and in their 5 or 7 minutes between classes, they all pull out their phones because they have to catch up on all the stuff that happened. School is such an important time for learning. Like, probably it would be good if they listened to their teachers, but they can't if they're always texting. And it's such an important time for social development. Probably be good if they actually played and talked with other kids, but they can't because everyone's on their phone. So phone-free schools is an absolute must. And that is happening. That I think we're going to win on.
On weekends, we're typically off on another adventure. Whether it's a scenic hike or a quaint town visit, I keep my Vessies with me because they effortlessly adapt to every twist and turn, ensuring comfort and style in our sometimes spontaneous escapades. Whether it's with the kids or just my husband and me, which is pretty rare, I love stepping into a great outdoor adventure with Vessies Stormburst boots to capture the beauty of springtime landscapes. Their robust style is perfect for our nature excursions, adding a little dash of elegance to our outdoor explorations. The Vessi collection caters to every style. Whether you're dressing up for a night out or gearing up for a weekend hike, these shoes seamlessly blend into your wardrobe while offering the practicality of waterproof footwear. Ready to refresh your spring wardrobe? Vessi has you covered with footwear that fuses style with practicality. Head over to vessi.com/outside to explore their versatile collection and automatically claim your 15% discount on your first order upon checkout. That's vessi.com/outside for 15% off your first order.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down,
or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No-Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
In the UK, they just mandated that schools must devise a phone-free policy. They have to figure out, are you going to lock them away in lockers or yonder pouches? So, you know, we'll get to the recommendations, but I'm actually very optimistic that we can change this.
Mm-hmm. I am too, because it's two main things. It's two things.
Yeah.
Come on, parents. I'm optimistic as well. And I think you have to read the book because you have to know about the micro dramas. It's an insight into what is actually going on. Like, you give statistics. These kids are getting interrupted every 5 to 10 minutes of their day mm-hmm. with notifications from their phone. And I loved, okay, so talking about these analogies, you were saying something like, you know, what if there's someone that's super smart mm-hmm. and they're trying to get through their day and every 5 minutes there's a buzz in their brain or, yeah. you know, it was something like that. And you think, well, of course,
that's right.
This is going to ruin the experience. And there was this also piece about, oh my goodness, Jonathan, that you have a brand identity.
Yeah.
So we have a little brand identity because I have a business, right?
You do, of course. Yes, yeah, an adult. Yeah.
Actually, just the other day. So we're trying to get outside. And my husband, he's got an account. It's 1,000 Hours Outside Dad. And he's posting these videos of, you know, he's in his 40s. We're just like old parents mm-hmm. here, right? He's like mm-hmm. shooting baskets in our local gym inside. And mm-hmm. I was like, that's off brand.
Whatever.
That's a funny thing. We just have a small family business and it's just mm-hmm. a joke. It wasn't a big deal. But these kids, on top of everything else that they're having to manage, they are managing an online brand. Can you sort of explain that to parents? Like, what are they having mm-hmm. to do?
Sure. So when you think about kids interacting, you know, imagine you interacting with your best friend when you were in, you know, fourth grade or ninth grade or whenever it was. Are you performing? Are you showing off? Not much. You know, you're telling jokes, you're gossiping, you're trying to figure out what to do. But now imagine that while you're talking to your best friend, 50 people are gathered around you watching and listening to your conversation. Well, now it's not. You're not bonding. You're more anxious. Like, what if I say something they don't like?
Yeah.
What happened during the Great Rewiring was before 2010, teens had flip phones, and a flip phone is good for communication because all you can do is telephone and text, really. And there's a little video game or something, but, you know, the telephone and text. And so you call your friend or you text your friend or your parents, and nobody's watching. It's just communicating. So technology is not bad. Phones are generally good things. The telephone is a good thing. Right now, you and I are on Zoom. This is a good thing because we can communicate directly, just you and me.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we know that there will be people watching. We know that. But it's just really different for a kid when they're having a private conversation versus they're performing on a stage. And how much of your child's childhood do you want them to spend performing on a stage versus bonding with their friends? For most of us, I'd say probably 0%. 0% sounds good to me for performing on a stage. The British have a phrase, "Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington." It's a line from an old song, and it especially captures the idea that girls especially, if you raise your daughter on a stage with lots of people looking at her and commenting on her and praising her for this feature or that feature, what a terrible thing to do to a developing girl. That's going to shape who she is, what she's afraid of, what she thinks of herself. So growing up on a stage is a terrible thing, especially for girls, but it's girls who are especially flocking to Instagram and other visual social media. The boys are doing video games and YouTube, which have their own problems, but it's not as bad for them as especially Instagram and other things where it's all about my face, my body. What do you think of my face and my body and my life? So yeah, we're warping child development and we got to stop.
Mm-hmm. There was a huge paragraph that you had talked to someone and she had said, it was something like, there are all of these certain ways that through social media, because girls are relational, that they are hurting each other mm-hmm. in terms of aggression. So it was called indirect aggression.
Yeah.
And you said, the way to really hurt another girl is to hit her in her relationships.
Yep.
You spread gossip, turn her friends against her, and lower her value as a friend to other girls. And so you talked about how the cyberbullying amongst girls surge. And I just wanted to read this one paragraph because I thought another thing, like, this is eye-opening. And I think it's tricky when you're a parent mm-hmm. and you're not in it.
Yeah.
I was a teacher before the iPhone came out, and I did see that mm-hmm. the Blackberries, the kids were hiding them in their laps.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a small glimpse into what it might be, but we're not there. So this is from young British women, Gen Z. This is on page 160 in my book, so people are picking it up. It might be a little different because I've got an advanced copy, but it'll be close.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, today, girls can drag each other down in all kinds of creative ways. There's passive aggression, the soft block, where you block and then unblock someone in quick succession so they no longer follow you, the read receipt, even a public tag in an unflattering photo.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mind-boggling to think.
It's like a multi-front war rather than, you know, it was hard enough, as you said, as so many people say this about seventh grade. Seventh grade is the peak year of bullying, especially for girls. I mean, middle school is really hard, especially for girls. Imagine you take all the worst parts of middle school and you multiply them by 10. That's what happens when you go through puberty on social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all of that information is in this book, The Anxious Generation. On the other hand, are the boys, you talk a lot about failure to launch. I thought one thing that was interesting that I never thought about, like, it's like one thing after the next, Jonathan, of, you know, you feel like you're in the know and then you're like, oh, well, I never thought about that. I never heard that.
Oh, that's great to hear as an author. That's what I want. That's what I was trying to do to the reader. Yes.
Yeah. So many things. So one thing that really changed for boys and young men is when physical jobs were replaced by more clerical jobs. Mm-hmm. And this was a shift. And then we've hit this spot where boys are not taking risks, girls too. But you say the lack of recess and the lack of time for kids to be out. And you say, mm-hmm. Here's a statement. Adolescent boys are now not much different than adolescent girls or from men in their 50s and 60s.
That's right. This was really shocking when I've been writing about the decline of risk-taking since The Coddling the American Mind with Greg Lukianoff, you know, if you're more anxious. But while writing The Anxious Generation, there are survey data from the kids themselves. Sometimes I like to do things that are a little risky. How much do you agree with that? So that goes down in this key period in the 2010s. But the amazing thing that we found is we found the CDC collects data on hospital admissions for unintentional injuries. You know, if you fall down, I don't think it includes car accidents. I've got to check. But it's, you know, if you fall down, you break a finger in basketball, whatever you're doing, you're doing something physical and you break a bone. So the CDC tracks that. And which group do you suppose gets injured the most? Which group do you suppose, you know, boys, girls, men, women, what age would you have guessed? gets into the most? Obviously, teenage boys. They're out there riding their bicycles, jumping off of roofs, you know, doing things that are reckless. They're, you know, drinking more. So for all kinds of reasons, of course, teenage boys are the ones who are most likely to be injured until 2010. Once everyone gets a phone and amazing multiplayer video games, the numbers for boys, the number of boys per 100,000 that are sent to a hospital for injury drops very rapidly to the point that by 2020, even before COVID, and certainly now, teenage boys are less likely to be injured than 50-year-old men, and they are less likely to be injured than teenage girls were 15 years ago, because boys are not doing anything that could break a bone. They can't even go over to each other's houses after school, because if you want to play video games, you have to go to your own house where you can put you have your own headset, your own controller, your own screen. So if that's what a boy's life is you're on your phone during school and you come home and you're on your video games and phone in the afternoon, there's nothing you can do that will break a bone. So some people might say, yay, that's great. They're not getting injured. But that also means they're not taking risks. They're not testing themselves. They're not growing stronger, tougher, more competent, more resilient. The conclusion, you know, there's so much focus on girls because social media harms girls. That's much more clear than harm for boys. But what's happening to boys, I believe, is they've basically been lured out of the physical world, in part pushed out. The physical world has gotten much more conducive to girls and women. And while that's great, it has also gotten less hospitable to men. School is much harder for boys. Boys aren't good at just sitting there for hours and trying to please the teacher. They want to be outside running. What do? We say no recess. Oh, and if you act out, no recess at all for you. Schools are really converted to a form that is, it's not great for girls, but at least girls can flourish in it much better than boys. And boys find, you know what? If I want to flourish, I can just be over here doing these amazing war games with my friends. I don't need all that school stuff. So boys are failing to do things that will turn them into men. They're failing to do things that will prepare them for adult male responsibilities. And as a result, they have declining employment, declining college graduation rates, declining employment, declining marriage. And so, you know, the future of our society, if they're not young men to become fathers and husbands, you know, we're in big, big trouble. I don't want to overstate it. Obviously, some young men are very fine. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. I'm a social scientist. So what I'm talking about is trends.
Yeah.
You know, most kids are not mentally ill. Most kids are getting jobs. So, you know, I have to be careful. I'm so passionate about this. I sometimes overstate things.
But then the statistics are large. I mean, the AI thing, and I think—
The trends, that's right. The trends are very large.
Right. I spent a week where I talked to some different people about artificial intelligence and generative artificial intelligence in particular. Mm-hmm. Jerry Kaplan came out with a new book. He's over at Stanford. And then even just a friend of ours who's in that world and he is married, but he has several AI girlfriends because he's testing.
Oh, no.
He's like in the testing thing.
And did he fall in love with him? Like, what did he say about
them? Well, yeah. I mean, this is a wild story, Jonathan, is that he went out to dinner with one. And, you know, his whole family knows what's going on. Obviously, it's all out in the open, but he's testing. He went out to dinner. You can, I guess, go out to dinner with your AI girlfriend. It can snap a picture and you can have a selfie. So he has a selfie of himself with the AI girlfriend.
In a restaurant?
In a restaurant.
And having a conversation with her? Wow. Like through headphones? Like, is he wearing headphones and talking to her?
It generates a photo. Yeah. You know, they're probably talking through a computer or phone.
A screen,
but
it
can create a photo where it makes it seem like you went on a date.
Oh my God.
So here's my selfie. And what happened, and this is so wild, Jonathan. The daughter said, oh, she wasn't dressed appropriately for that restaurant. It was something like that. Maybe she should have been dressed too, she wasn't dressed nice enough, or she was too dressy. Or, and they said, you should tell your AI girlfriend to change her outfit for that picture.
Okay.
And our friend, who is an adult man, father, mm-hmm. husband,
yeah,
he said, I can't do it. He felt too bad. He felt so uncomfortable, even though he knew it's a computer. So that piece of it where he talked about, and other people are, that there's character AI and these new virtual worlds where people are spending already 20 million people spending 2 hours a day. So we're already tipping that over into the AI companion space. And you had talked about, and I never heard of this either, the acronym NEET, N-E-E-T.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not in education, employment, or training.
Yeah. And that's where a lot of our boys are headed.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. So in Japan, they have what are called the hikikomori. These are young men who, especially in the 1990s, after the Japanese economy collapsed and employment was harder, a lot of young men, this was the early internet era, they were ashamed that they didn't have a job. They would go into their bedroom and then they would just live on their computers. Their mothers would bring them food and leave it at the door, and they never went out. And some of those boys are now in their 50s. They're now in their 50s, and their parents are in their 70s and 80s, and the parents don't know what they're going to do when they die. Who's going to care for their 50-year-old son who's never been out of his bedroom? So that's the extreme of what can happen. And I think we're headed that way for a lot of young men, especially, I mean, because they already have incredible pornography free whenever they want it. They already have incredible pseudo war. It's very exciting whenever they want it. If they can actually have the companionship of a woman who is much more beautiful than any real woman could be, because you can perfectly optimize her, who has the most wonderful personality. You'll never get in fights with her. She'll always defer to you or whatever. Or maybe if you want her to be argumentative, you can make her argumentative. So I think we're already losing a lot of boys. And I think once AI really takes off, and especially the goggle computing, I think if we don't act now, if we don't restore the play-based childhood, if we don't restore childhood in the real world, if we don't say this stuff is just not appropriate for children, I think we're going to lose a lot more boys to virtual friends and girlfriends. Mm-hmm.
It's a tall order. And what I always have said, and my thought is that there was a time when, and you talked about it, there was a time when the way that society was structured saved childhood because there wasn't anything to watch on TV. Mm-hmm. And so you had to go find something to do. You had less toys. The video games weren't as immersive. And now this tall order is on, I feel like it falls on my shoulders. It falls on the mm-hmm. shoulders of my husband. And it's a lot. And you say, I actually really like what you said in the book. You acknowledge that this is hard. Then you say, though, it's harder to be an adolescent. And I think that's a really important piece. But one of the things that we're struggling with, Jonathan, even just as like right now, like in this exact moment, we have teenagers and tweens and then some littler kids, is even just finding friends is such a tricky piece. And can we talk about this mm-hmm. part of, and I thought it was so interesting, another one that I really hadn't thought about was obviously if kids are on their phones, and a lot of kids are on their phones, there's less social interaction, you know, social deprivation. There is really good stuff in this book. It's so good. You say this, and I'd never thought about this. Even when teens are within a few feet of their friends, their phone-based childhood damages the quality of their time together. Mm-hmm. I had a kid say just the other day, I was just really, it's emotional. It's really hard. He said, Mom, I'm so lonely.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't mean to come out here and cry to you.
No, you're right. No, I mean, I talk about the data, the statistics, the trends, but these are kids who are hurting. These are kids who are suffering. And then any parent that wants to do the right thing and say, you know what, I'm not going to give you a phone until you're 14. I'm not going to let you get on Instagram or TikTok until you're 16. You're condemning your kid to more social isolation. So this is the trap that we're in. But I think the most important idea in the book is that these traps are what we call collective action traps or collective action problem. And this is the key to solving them. You know, how did it happen that we did this thing? And a lot of us know that it's bad for the kids and the kids know it's bad for them, but why are we all doing it? And the reason is because everyone else is doing it. And so it's hard to be the only one. But what if you're not the only one? What if we organize in groups to all do it together? Once I realized this, these are all just collective action problems, then it made me really optimistic because, you know, normally if you want to change society, like on global warming, oh, you have to persuade people to recycle and that might be hard, whatever it is that you want to do, like you have to persuade people to change. Here, we don't have to do that because most parents are concerned. They're afraid of what's happening. They want to do something. They just don't know what. So what I did in the book is I proposed four norms, four simple norms that are easy to follow if we do them together. And so let's just go through them. Yeah. The first norm is no smartphone till high school. Yeah. By all means, send your kid out. You and I need to talk a lot more about the outdoor play, but by all means, send your kids out to play and they don't need a phone, but okay, you know, I understand. I live in New York City. When we sent my kids out, we wanted to see where they were. We didn't want to just, you know, wonder where they are. So, when they were in fourth grade, fifth grade. So, fine, give your kid a basic phone, give them a flip phone. You can give them something that you can even track, but no smartphone. Don't give them the internet in their pocket until high school. We've got to rip all of this stuff out of middle school and elementary school, all of it. That's the first norm. Hard to do if you do it on your own, you're isolating your kid, but easy to do if you and the parents of your kid's friends, five of you, five families, all do it together. Then it's easy because now the kids have to play with each other. Yeah. That's norm number one. Norm number two, no social media till 16. So really health-wise, it should be 18. I mean, social media just is not for minors. It's not for children. It's got all kinds of drugs and sex and people being run over by cars and horrible racist stuff. I mean, it's full of garbage.
Yeah.
And the benefits are so trivial and they vanish. The benefits are not much.
And I liked what you said, because this was such a big thing too. When you talked about social media and the conformity piece, how powerful it is for conformity, because normally you have to observe so many people to figure out mm-hmm. what are societal norms. And then on social media, with all the likes and the numbers, it's like within a couple hours, you can have thousands of data points.
Yeah.
And what you said was, I thought was so interesting, is that parents are no match for that.
That's right.
In terms of the influence that we want to have. My kids are not just shy of 16, our oldest. I mean, asking for social media all the time. Mm-hmm. And we have held that line, but it is not easy.
No, that's right.
But you read a book like this and it definitely increases your resolve. And even that piece of it just is, we are no match for that. That's a whole other piece of the social media.
Yeah, that's right. So my hope is that if a lot of people buy the book or read my Substack or watch my talks online, and there are others. Gene Twenge has been doing amazing research as well. That suppose your kids are in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, and if a bunch of other parents of kids in that school have read this stuff and they see that we need to change, and now if 10 of you get together, or if the school, we'll move on to the schools in a moment, if the school sends out a message asking parents to delay smartphones till high school, well, now it becomes much, much easier. So again, these are collective action problems, hard to solve as an individual, easy to solve collectively. So we've done no smartphone till high school, no social media till 16. Yep. The third norm is phone-free schools. And as we were saying before, once the kids have access to the phones in school, they're not paying attention to their teachers or to each other. It's devastating. Academic achievement is going down since 2012 in this country and around the world. I mean, it's insane. Our kids are getting stupider because they're not paying attention in school. How could they? There's too much drama going on in the virtual world. So schools must lock up the phones in the morning, either in a yonder pouch or a phone locker. That's the third norm. And that one is easy to do. We're going to win. It's happening.
Oh, hey, everybody. It's us, Blair and Molly, your old pals from Toddler Purgatory. Two moms who are also actors, who are also creative beings, who sometimes feel stuck.
And now we're back with a whole new podcast about unsticking it, launching in January. What happens when life gets in the way of our creativity instead of nourishing it?
We talk to all sorts of guests about how to break through the mucky, gluey, sticky wall that can get between you and your creativity. We hear about their journeys, their successes, their challenges, and even their bougie coffee shop orders.
So, join us, won't you, as we deep dive into how to unstick ourselves from the life gunk that can get in the way of our creative freedom.
Get out of there, life gunk.
Let us help you get back to your best creative self. Look for Unsticking It with Blair and Molly.
Wherever you listen to podcasts, starting in January.
Unsticking It with Blair and Molly. Because sometimes life sucks.
Unsticking It. No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tiny humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
And then the fourth norm is the hard one, and this is where we should probably spend our remaining time.
Yeah.
The fourth one is more independence, free play, and responsibility in the real world. And this is the one that's going to be harder for Americans. I think we can change norms around the phones very quickly because everyone hates it. The teachers hate it. The parents hate it. Even the kids actually don't like it. The kids can see that this is the cause of their problems, but they feel trapped. But getting Americans to listen to you and to send their kids out, you know, we're making progress on that, but that's much harder because now you're asking parents to overcome their fears. So I would urge everyone, if you're listening to this, please go to letgrow.org. Have you had Lenore Scanese on the program?
Yeah, you must have. She's been on. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So Lenora and I started this organization in 2017 with Peter Gray, a play researcher. Yeah,
Peter Gray's been on a couple of times too.
Oh, good. Very good. Okay. So your listeners will be familiar with this whole idea. But especially if you have anything to do with the school, an elementary or middle school, or if you are involved in your kid's elementary or middle school, urge the school to start doing the Let Grow experience. It's a very, very simple program. It's incredibly powerful. All it is the homework assignment. Let's imagine a whole third grade class. The homework assignment, kids, take the sheet of paper home to your parents. You and your parents, you are going to suggest something that you've never done before that you think you can do. Maybe it's walk the dog. Maybe you've never been allowed to walk the dog by yourself. Maybe it's to go to a store three blocks away. Whatever it is, you think of something that you think you can do, you've never done. Agree with your parents about it and then do it. And the amazing thing is that parents who would not let their kid walk to the store if the kid just asked, but now it's a homework assignment and everyone's doing it. That's what's so brilliant about this. Yeah. Everyone else is doing it because parents are terrified of being judged, especially mothers. We're very harsh. People are always judging mothers based on what they see the kid doing. But if everyone has to do it, then everyone does it. And then guess what? If the whole town has this happening, if 8-year-olds are going to the store and getting milk, then within a few weeks, people have seen 8-year-olds out in public. And it begins to see, it'll look weird at first. But after a few weeks, they'll say, oh yeah, of course they can do that. I did that when I was 7. Mm-hmm. So the Let Grow Project changes norms. It gives parents a chance to feel that anxiety of, my kid is out without my protection. What's going to happen? And you realize nothing. Nothing's going to happen except your kid's going to grow. Your kid's going to become a self-supervising, functioning human being.
And you're going to grow as a parent. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest points too. And Dr. Jean Twenge said, and it was something that stuck out to me so deeply, as she said, the kids are getting to college and they can't make simple decisions without texting their parents. But that's not what a parent wants. But it's a both process.
That's right.
You have to learn as a parent to trust your kid while they're learning to trust themselves. And Peter Gray was walking to the store when he was 4. So if your kid is 8, that's double
the
age.
That's right. We have a line, I forget where it's from. It's a piece of folk wisdom in the coddling. The job of a parent is to work him or herself out of a job. And please don't start that job when your kid goes off to college. Please start it when the kid is 4 or 5, so they learn to do things on their own. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a bit about outside play. Because I know that nature is important. I know that we are refreshed by nature. But what you're saying is not just go out and play on a playground. So just tell me more about why nature play is so important compared to just like go out to the ball field and make up a game or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, even that's important too. And Peter Gray talks about
it is outside.
When we were kids, if you're going to go and it's a pickup game of sports, you're having to figure out all the rules. Kids don't get injured because they don't want the game to end. They're intrinsically motivated. So there's a lot of that, but that's not really going on right now in terms of sports. Youth sports are definitely adult directed in most cases.
Yeah.
It's not those pickup games. But when kids go outside, it helps them in every facet of their development. It helps their cognition because when kids play and they rough and tumble and they challenge their bodies, which they do all the way through the teen years. Mm-hmm. We've actually been living this way, Jonathan, since our oldest was 3 and he's almost 16, where we have had a goal of getting outside every year for 1,000 hours. It's research based. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat based on balancing out screens and real life and that sort of thing. And it has still worked. It's a surprising piece of information that I wouldn't have known when I had these really small children who are now teens and tweens, that it just looks different. Now they're riding skateboards and they're doing tricks on their bike.
Yeah.
And they're sitting at picnic tables with a bunch of friends and they're talking. I think the play looks like that too. It's a social play with words. But when they're moving in complex ways, it's enhancing the neural wiring of their brain. So you talked about in your
movement,
book.
Embodied. It's embodied.
Yes. And I love that. There was a statement I thought, we are at the point where we have to say we have to have embodied experiences. I thought we have really come quite far to have to be saying these things, that we need to be in person. But you say experience, not information, is the key to emotional mm-hmm. development. So we're talking about cognition. That's obviously a big piece. Parents are super concerned about grades. Socially, I mean, this is where you learn your social skills. That's you're right. coming up with something out of nothing. You're having to come up with elaborate play schemes. You have to use your creativity. You have to be able to negotiate. Mm-hmm. All of that's happening. You've got the emotional respite piece of just the beauty of nature and letting your eyes relax. I mean, there's so much to that and taking all of that in. Yeah. And then obviously the physical piece, which, okay, one of the things we talk about a lot is risk. That risk is a, I learned this from a guy who does adventure photography. His name is, it's on Masterclass. I think his name is Christian, I'm pretty sure, Christopher Chin, but he does adventure photography. So he's skiing through the, you know, the mountains and he's taking photos. Oh, and what he says is risk management, risk calculation. Yeah. You actually calculate it. You don't know you're calculating mm-hmm. it, but it's a combination of how dangerous is this mm-hmm. as well as how likely is it to happen.
Yep.
And so when you have a young child that climbs up onto a small stump, that's not very dangerous. It's mm-hmm. very likely that they're going to fall off and cry and you're going to have to console them and get out your Band-Aids or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's not super risky.
Exactly. It's low risk.
But we're stopping our kids, right, even from that. So what you said, I thought this was such a huge statement. You said, this is big, maybe the state is engaging in neglect when it mandates overprotection.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The state is, but when states pass laws or when they interpret their laws about child endangerment, such that if you leave your 11-year-old kid in the car while you go in to, you know, drop off something in a store, and if someone calls the police about your 11-year-old child who could have been a babysitter 30 years ago, but now needs a babysitter, you know, if the state is making people afraid to even leave their 11-year-old alone, then basically it's forcing us to neglect their needs for independence.
Mm-hmm. It's big that the lack of risks is risky.
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest thing. It's counterintuitive. There is so much in here about play. And I just want for parents to know, like I said, I have 14 pages of notes from this book, Jonathan, and I had to be judicious to have it be that little amount of notes. I was like, oh, if it's 30 pages of notes, there's no way I'm going to even be able to find what I need to find. Mm-hmm. There are so many things in here. You say, it's hard to hurt yourself on these things. You're talking about the new playgrounds, which means children don't learn much about how not to get hurt. It's a bigger risk than to not encourage kids to take prudent risk-taking. Children need to jump off the swing. They need to have adventure. They need to explore in the forest. You talk about the six types of risk. I'm rattling through because I want parents to know that there is so much in here. And this is just the chapter on play. And what's wild to me, Jonathan, you talk about nature, awe walks, recess, discover mm-hmm. mode versus defend mode. I mean, parents have to read about that's in there. I didn't know about that, the discover mode versus defend mode. And even just the acknowledgement of that we need embodied experiences and it has to be synchronous. All of this, one-to-one or one-to-several, high bar for entry and exit. The way that you boiled it down is brilliant.
Oh, well, thank you.
Brilliant. And all of these different pieces where you take it from a different perspective and the parent realizes, oh my goodness, this is what I've been doing. I need to make a change. You talk about the nude photographs. Nude photographs function as a kind of currency in many middle and high schools. A middle school student in New Jersey. Yep. Says that boys in her grade try to persuade girls to send them nude photos of themselves, which the boys then sell to high school boys in exchange for alcohol.
Yeah, it's sick. Yeah.
So these are the things that I think parents have no idea.
That's right.
No idea what's going on. And I have just scratched the surface on this phenomenal book that if every parent in the country read it and the teachers read it, that things could change in a week, in a day. It's these two big things that have changed. So just a phenomenal book. It's called The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. I'm concerned about these kids. How are they going to be able to parent if they've never embodied synchronous experiences, if they haven't experienced it themselves?
You also
have Substack, which you update a lot, and there's a lot of articles on there, and I'll link to that in the show notes, and then also anxiousgeneration.com. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's afterbabble.com. The Substack is at afterbabble.com. And then the website for the book is anxiousgeneration.com.
Mm-hmm. And then people can check out Let Grow. So there's a lot here. The other books are great too. I mean, The Coddling of the American Mind, when you showed like the entry requirements, it was like the entry requirements to kindergarten in 1960 versus 2010 or 2000.
Yeah, it was first grade, right? Is your kid ready for first grade? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, can they walk to a friend's house? I mean, this That's used right. to
can
be.
Can they walk 6 blocks without adult supervision? Can they walk by themselves 6 blocks? Yeah. It used to be that you were expected to do that before you start first grade. And now we say, we're not going to let you do that until like fifth grade, which is insane.
And now we say, well, you have to know all of the capitals. And it's just changed to this information glut as opposed to experience.
That's right.
So there is so much to enrich your family life. We're running out of time. We're right at the end. And I have to ask you the question that we always ask. But I'm hoping that I'm letting people, everybody know. Like you say, these answers cost nothing. I have a whole bunch of notes in here about relationships, which are so important. I mean, people are really struggling with anxiety, family dynamics, that this has become a constant conflict. Parents try to lay down the rules and enforce limits, but there are so many devices. And it is so hard. It is so unbelievably hard. It's a societal issue, not a family issue. You will get so much out of this book. It is absolutely worth your time to read, The Anxious Generation, and could not be more timely. Everybody needs it. And I love this. Happiness tends to occur in clusters. Eating is the one deficiency that the virtual world can never overcome, no matter how good VR gets. So like this, you know, dining together.
Eating together. Yeah. Yeah. It's really deep. It's part of our evolutionary histories. We break bread together. We eat together. And that makes us friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This thing after thing after thing, Jonathan, what a book.
Oh, well, thank you, Jenny.
It really has meant so much to me and our family. It's given us a lot to talk about and a lot of changes to make. Our last question, so I don't miss it because otherwise people get mad. What is a favorite memory from your childhood that was outside?
Oh, wow. Well, the one, I mean, I've got so many that are favorites, but the one that just instantly pops to mind, a very vivid memory, is my best friend, Krista, and I getting in a rock fight with kids at a neighboring church school. We would cut through their parking lot in order to go down to the store, the village area of our town. And they didn't like that because boys are territorial. We were enemies on their territory. One of them threw a rock at us and we threw a rock back. And before you knew it, we were having a rock fight. But here's the thing, and this is what boys do. We made rules. We said, okay, you can't aim at the person's head. Okay. If someone gets hit, yet we time out, make sure they're okay. And then we went back to throwing rocks at each other. Now, that is risky. That was really risky. But man, was it exciting. And so that's the sort of thing. Of course, we could never have done that if there were adults around, and could never have done it if we were inside. And so that's the kind of risk taking that boys need. And we had rule, like, you have to throw small rocks. Like, you can't like throw a large rock that could really, you know, but that's, you know, that was a thrilling memory.
Mm-hmm. And kids are smart. I mean, what a thing to remind parents at. What wisdom. Here you are, your kids, you're throwing rocks. And it seems like that's not a wise thing to do. But kids know. They don't really want to hurt someone else. They're testing these things out.
That's exactly. That's right. It was a game. We didn't really want to hurt them. We wanted to win the game, but we didn't want to actually hurt them. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was thrilling. Jonathan, I mean, I have been waiting years, and this has been an honor of my lifetime. Your books have been so influential to us, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to be here. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks, Jenny. I honor you for your work. Getting kids outside is such a big part of the solution. So thank you for your work.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.